we have having Judge Longhorn talking about when Thaksin ruled the world, reviewing his lot democracy. Let us now come to today's proceedings. We're very happy to have Audrey Yu with us here. She is, of course, a leading member of the Bar, a founding member of the Civic Party, the leader of the Civic Party, and as I discovered last night, a dangerous radical. I moved just slightly to the right because I didn't want to be affected by that. She, as you know, was part of what has been for Hong Kong a historic event. We have never had a debate on television about a specific government policy prior to its presentation before the Legislative Council. I wonder whether the people who advised the Chief Executive to hold that debate are perhaps his closest advisers this morning, because if you believe what the opinion polls, and the Chief Executive told us he's much more interested in opinion polls these days, if you believe what the opinion polls say, it wasn't a good result for him last night. So we're very happy to have Audrey Yu with us to talk about the morning after the day before. There's a question that gentlemen are not supposed to ask. I'm not a gentleman, so I can ask it. You're not supposed to ask a lady, well, you know, the day after, how was it for you? That's the question I'm asking. And Audrey Yu has rather graciously agreed to spend more time answering questions and making a relatively brief introduction. So please welcome Audrey Yu.
For that introduction, well, there is one bit I need to quarrel with. That's the bit, not about the dangerous radical bit, but the leading member of the Bar bit, because these days I really have so little time for court. I long for gentlemanly debates, and that bit, unfortunately, is no longer true. Thank you, Steve, and FCC for organizing this luncheon gathering, and thank you all very much for coming. I thought you might have had enough of me last night, and I'm so glad to see still such a full turnout. I must begin by thanking the Chief Executive for inviting me to the debate. I think it really sets a new chapter in Hong Kong politics and the political culture, because it's very important that the public actually get a chance to see the two different sides of the argument being put forward in the debating style. I wish there will be more of these debates in future, and I hope they will be better organized in the sense of allowing more public participation. If you were in Central last night, you would have seen the great police presence. It was like a curfew. And I didn't realize that debates would have to be held under such heavy police escort and security. So I wish, you know, future debates would be much more open, more public participation. In fact, 3 years ago, when Donald Zhang had a debate with Alan Leung here, we had a much freer atmosphere where members of the public were allowed into the debating room, and lots were drawn as to who could turn up, and also questions would be put forward by the public themselves. And unfortunately, in that sense, last night was actually a regression. So I hope in future we would have more open debates. Secondly, I'd like to thank all the people who sent me all sorts of faxes, emails, and letters, and who gave me tips, opinions when I ran across them in the streets. They were extremely, extremely helpful to me, and I was very, very grateful for the public support and attention and interest in the debate. That, of course, also put a lot of pressure on me. It was a very high expectation. And therefore, I really had to also thirdly thank my team for really helping me out. And there are two members here, Alan and Albert, both from the Civic Party. And Albert conducted the negotiations with the city office as to the arrangements for the debate. And Alan, of course, had personal experience debating the chief executive 3 years ago. So it's very funny when we had the drills. And Alan was telling me all sorts of things I shouldn't do, which was exactly the sort of thing I was telling him 3 years ago when he was in the hot seat. So it's actually quite funny. And I had a lot of good advice, a lot of training from my team. And I am extremely, extremely grateful for that. I wouldn't have been able to do it without them. I set out to do this debate with probably something like three objectives. The first one I wanted to do was to explain to Hong Kong people why we have to oppose it. Because I know Hong Kong people really want to move forward with constitutional reform. They feel that this has been going on, this argument has been going on for so long, and there is a desperate need just to move, some kind of move anywhere. And a move is, you know, better than no move at all. And it's very important, therefore, I need to explain my reasons, or the Civic Party's reasons, for not supporting the proposal. It's not like a sort of gym exercise when you just move somewhere, somehow, your feet or your leg. I mean, you have to move in the right direction towards universal suffrage. And I had to explain why this package, this proposal, wasn't really going to help in that direction. Why, in fact, it was going to entrench functional constituencies and even more small circle elections, which was difficult to get rid of. The second objective I wanted to do was really to tell the chief executive that he has to get the job done. It's his constitutional duty. Because throughout last 5 years ago, and even now, he's trying to paint the Democrats as those who are obstructing reform, those who stand in the way of Hong Kong moving forward. And it's the most and fairest criticism of all, because we all want to move forward. And it's really his duty to come up with the right package, the roadmap that's going to lead us in the right direction towards universal suffrage. He was not doing his duty and was trying to load the blame on us. And that really was the unkindest cut of all. And that was the point I wanted to make to him. And he still has 2 years of his term, and he really ought to make good use of his 2 years to come up with a roadmap that leads us to genuine universal suffrage. The third objective I wanted to do, to achieve, which I didn't really had enough time to do, was to explain to Hong Kong people why constitutional reform is important for Hong Kong, for people's livelihood. Because if you really want a harmonious society, you really need a fair system. It doesn't mean it's going to cure all problems. We never promised that, and it doesn't work that way. But functional constituencies are causing problems. They are the obstacle. And we need a fair system in order that we have the best form of government, the kind of competition that Hong Kong people are used to. And in fact, a lot of people in Hong Kong feels it's really about daily, you know, livelihood. And I wanted to explain that constitutional reform is very basic to people's livelihood. And it's hurting Hong Kong a lot. Because when you think of the government's slogan, Act Now, in Chinese, actually, it actually means lifting the anchor. And I really wanted to say that the anchor was not put there by Hong Kong people. It's actually put there by the central authorities with a string of broken promises, as well as by people with vested interest, or bodies with vested interest, who would not allow us to move forward to a fair system. This caused a lot of split, a lot of conflict, and even anger, in particular amongst the grassroots, also amongst young people who look forward to a society that really does what it preaches, and that's justice and fair play. And Hong Kong is a city that's built on justice and fair play. And the longer this obstacle is not resolved, the longer we are denied a fair system, the greater is the damage to Hong Kong. And I would have loved greater time to bring forward this point in the debate. But as you know, in the custom thrust, and also you're limited in terms of every point you make to a few tenths of seconds, not more than 1 minute, it's actually difficult to put a point like that across. So I don't think I really achieved or succeeded in my third objective. But I'm sure there'll be more debates, and I'm sure these kind of debates and exchanges will continue to be practiced in different areas, and particularly in a place like FCC. So I'm sure you can all get what you want from the debate, and I hope the debate will continue in every corner of Hong Kong, and I look forward one day to really having a fair system in Hong Kong. And I would prefer more questions than really a long speech. I'm sure you're all tired of me by now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. It's the usual procedure here. If you just indicate if you want to ask a question, identify yourself and your organisation if you feel so inclined. I'm going to shamelessly take the first question. I think on one or two occasions last night, you asked the chief executive whether, if he failed to get through these constitutional package, he would consider resigning. Is it your point of view that this is what he should be doing?
Actually, I didn't ask him that question. I said, he didn't get the job done. But there was a question from the members of the public. In fact, that was the first question from the member of the public. It was directed to the chief executive, asking him whether he would resign if he doesn't get the package through, because this would be his second attempt. And really, he was forcing the similar kind of package. My own personal view is that he still has 2 years remaining of his term. And since it was his election promise when he debated Allen, that he was going to resolve the issue of universal suffrage completely once and for all during his term. And since he kept on saying that he got the timetable, then I think it's about time he should make good use of the remainder of his term to get us a roadmap. And therefore, in a way, I think even if this package does not go through, and of course the voting would be, unless it's changed, would be on Wednesday, I think the pressure would be there, because last time when the NETCO voted down the package in 2005, it in fact prompted the chief executive to make a report to MPC saying over 60% of the Hong Kong people in fact want universal suffrage, early universal suffrage. And as a result, then MPC decision gave us the so-called timetable. So my question to the chief executive was that even if this package again second time is voted down, he can again ask the MPC, saying, well, for example, if you look at the Hong Kong U poll 2 days ago, over 70% of the Hong Kong people want to abolish functional constituencies by latest 2016. And in fact, one of my questions to him was, I quoted from this Hong Kong U poll, and asked CE whether in fact he would heed and do as that public poll showed. And he didn't answer the question at all, because he had a script in front of him and was just reading from the script. So irrespective of what question I asked him, he was just reading out from the script.
How do you do? I'm Bonnie Engel, longtime Hong Kong resident. Unfortunately, at the FCC, they were playing most of the debate in Cantonese, which I don't understand very much of. And we had a wine committee meeting, which of course supersedes all else in the club. But my question is, both of you in the debate are debating a question that is not necessarily solvable between the two of you. There's a ghost in the room or an elephant in the room that we're not discussing. And do you feel the chief executive has to have the priorities he has from a different source?
Thank you for the question. Of course, well, first of all, was there simultaneous interpretation? Because I understood that they had, and so I don't know whether it was shown on television. Yeah. To your main question, definitely a lot of people in Hong Kong think the political reality is the central authorities have really the upper hand and the complete say. But in fact, in the debate, I pointed out that actually, when it comes to legal election, it ought to be a matter of internal affairs. It is very important to make that point, because Basic Law Article 1 deals with, Annex 1 deals with election of the chief executive, and originally there was a three-step procedure, and the last step was about approval from the MPC. For election of LegCo, Annex 2 actually says that you only have to keep the, send the record to the MPC. And if you look at the previous records before the turnover, before the handover, in 1993, for example, in the Renmin Yibribao, the Foreign Affairs for Chinese government actually published the exchanges between the Chinese government and the British government at that time, dealing with the drafting of the Basic Law. And also there was a publication of the interview of Director of Macau Affairs, Lu Ping, and they made it also very, very clear that when it came to legal election, it's a matter of internal affairs. And that is absolutely right, because it's only national defense and foreign affairs that should belong to Beijing. And so when it comes to abolition of functional constituencies, it really ought to be Hong Kong affairs. But what has happened is that the functional constituencies, the people with vested interests, refuse to go. And they go to Beijing and tell Beijing that, look, you have to protect us. And the funny thing, I mean, if you look at recent developments, for example, you see when the Democratic Party put forward their recent proposal for these five new seats to be elected by the public instead of by the district council members, all the pro-establishment forces says, no, we don't agree with something like that. And then, of course, you see a sudden change from Elsie Leung, from Rao Guoping, the Beijing professor. And then suddenly, yesterday, all the pro-establishment legislators changed their stance. And they said, yeah, we can talk about that, and we'll agree to that. I mean, it just shows you that it ought to be a matter of internal affairs. If you know, we Hong Kong people are determined and say, look, this was what was promised. Functional constituencies were meant to be transitional. You look at all the drafts, you look at all the historical material, that was what was promised. And my question always to Hong Kong people is this, that you always tell me that, well, Beijing doesn't like this, Beijing doesn't like that, so we shouldn't do this, we shouldn't do that. But I said, Basic Law was promised to us by Beijing. One country, two system was promised to us by Beijing. High degree of autonomy is promised to us by Beijing. Hong Kong people ruling Hong Kong is promised to us by Beijing. Now, the only thing we can defend Hong Kong in terms of the one country, two systems is by sticking to the Basic Law. If we give up and keep retreating, we would have nowhere to go. And so there is nothing wrong, there's nothing radical about sticking to promises. And if you give in on principle, you are going to have no leg to stand on. So don't say, look, Beijing doesn't like it, so we're not going to fight. We fight in a legitimate, polite way by saying, look, this wasn't what was promised, and please have regard to public opinion. And if public opinion is on our side, we have to believe that Beijing will listen. 2003, 1st of July, 500,000 people came out and marched. And what happened? The government shelved Article 23 legislation, national security legislation. So never underestimate people's power. You may say, you may criticize me for doing the five district referendum. You may say, well, that was a failure. Yes, it was a poor turnout rate, 17.1%, but still 500,000 people. And the objective was to give the decision back to the people so they could participate in constitutional reform. And that's, you know, the aim, that I cannot fight Beijing, but the Hong Kong people can. And that's what the democratic movement is about.
One thing I'd like to ask your opinion is that, assuming that you've just been voted down the this proposal, what might be the likely scenarios that would be happening to Hong Kong? Secondly, I also hear from the news that there is negotiation ongoing that about some amendments, and the Democrats, is under consideration whether to accept it or not. And what's your view on that?
The situation at the moment, of course, is touch and go, because we're really only a few days from the vote. And my assessment is that the government actually would not move the day, but I may be wrong on that. Then these are critical few days, because the ball actually is at the moment in the court of the central authorities, the central government. And if they approve the Democratic Party's proposal, then the package will go through, because then it will be left to local legislation to implement that. And your other part of the question is, what if it doesn't go through? What if, for example, the central authority says no, there will be no, therefore, concessions, and the Democratic Party will vote against the package, so the government would not have enough votes for the package to go through? Then I think the tension would be up and up. There will be people asking Donald Trump to resign. My own personal position is that it's much better that he would then fight for a roadmap, because then he can actually tell the central authorities that, look, public opinion is actually not on my side. I've tried twice. So it's really time to give Hong Kong people a roadmap. And that's how I feel the tension can be kept up. And that's really, I think, the hope we can really get some kind of roadmap to real universal suffrage, rather than going on a detour. The reason why I mention a detour, of course, is that I understand the Democratic Party's stance, and I don't criticize them for doing what they're doing. But my worry is this. First of all, let's think of the Hong Kong people. Since November last year, the government has been consulting the Hong Kong public on one proposal and one proposal alone. And then suddenly, less than a week before the vote, suddenly there is a new shift, a different stance. And there is no consultation? I mean, how do you regard, where do you place Hong Kong public? I mean, was the consultation a sham then? I mean, isn't public opinion important? Shouldn't they be told about the new package? Shouldn't the details be explained? Because very often the devil is in the details, and yet it's left to local legislation. It has writ across implications for functional constituencies, because already last night I watched Miriam Lau on television when she was asked about the Democratic Party proposal. And she said, oh, it's great, because then everybody has to vote, so functional constituencies can stay. Now, that is my greatest worry, that it's going to give functional constituencies the excuse that now everything is fair because everybody has to vote. But that, in fact, is twisting the meaning of universal suffrage, because not only do you have an equal number of votes, the weighting of the votes got to be equal as well. If you take the Democratic Party proposal, it only means 5 seats out of the 35 functional constituency seats being given to 3.2 million voters. So about 600,000 voters get to vote for one legislator. Whereas if you look at the current functional constituencies, 100 or so companies or bodies get to vote for one legislator. The iniquity lies in the very unequal distribution of power or the weighting of the votes. It's not in the number of seats. And the package does nothing to resolve that. And my worry is that if the timetable for universal suffrage is real, you are talking about 3 steps to universal suffrage of LegCo, 2012, 2016, 2020. Now you have to make every step count. Now if you then say, let's forget the ultimate aim for the moment and just have a negotiation on the interim. You're going to spend your energy on the interim. You're going to give the excuse for functional constituencies to be kept. And how many steps would it take to get us to real universal suffrage? Because this is what I call the diluting theory. It's diluting the functional constituency. That can take us to 2047. If you think of it that way, you are diluting 5 seats out of 35. How much longer is it going to take you to get to real universal suffrage? Now, I am only 1 out of 7 million people in Hong Kong. If 7 million people in Hong Kong, or 5 million or whatever it is, says, look, Audrey, I don't really mind. Yeah, universal suffrage is really pie in the sky, although it's promised in the basic law, but it's never going to happen. Let's stick to reality and let's go for a detour. Well, then of course that's the public opinion and I have to stick to that. But at the moment, I don't see the public being consulted and being told about the reality of what it means and the implication it has for functional constituencies. Because, as I said, it has writ across implications. What about for legal functional constituencies? Will it mean, for example, a nomination by bodies in the legal profession? Say the Bar Association nominate one candidate, the Law Society nominate one candidate, and the public choose. But British Chamber of Commerce or Chinese Chamber of Commerce nominate one candidate and everybody, one man, one vote. I mean, is that the kind of reformed functional constituencies that we are going for? I think the public has a right to know. As I said, at the end of the day, if everybody, or not everybody, but the majority agrees with it, well, then that's public opinion, that's Hong Kong's decision. But until we have debated that issue, I don't think we ought to rush down that route. And so currently, my opinion, and I believe Civic Party's opinion, although we're going to have our general meeting on Monday, currently I believe the Civic Party thinks that this is not the way to go unless and until we have a genuine, informed public debate about it.
Can I just ask you about something, in fact, you were discussing earlier? Where are we now with One Country, Two Systems, in view of the fact that there are now direct negotiations with central government officials and members of political parties in Hong Kong which seem to bypass the local authorities?
I am very concerned about that. I made the point of the debate last night. I also made that point on many different occasions. I think our chief executive has a constitutional duty to tell the central authorities that really China Liaison Office is not governing Hong Kong. I am very worried seeing officers from the China Liaison Office coming out and saying this and that in relation to our legislative election. This ought to be matter of internal affairs. And increasingly you see Hong Kong people, when they go to protest, they go to the China Liaison Office. That is not the development that we want to see for One Country, Two Systems, if that's really meant to be genuine One Country, Two Systems. I can understand Beijing having an interest in stability in Hong Kong, but they really ought to trust the chief executive to do his job. They really need to trust Hong Kong people to be able to choose their own legislators. And I feel that whatever negotiations that ought to be conducted through the CE office, and the public ought to be able to perceive that the CE office is in control and not the China Liaison Office.
Hello, I'm Florence Changi, French reporter with the New Newspaper. Is it fair to say that, I mean, listening to you, when you think of 2017 and 2020, say you do nothing and no one really moves, you're not trusting that things will happen as promised?
Well, even if things move, even if the package goes through, it doesn't mean that we're going to have necessarily universal suffrage in 2017 and 2020.
It's not a commitment.
Well, if you look at the MPC decision, and by the way, last night at the debate, the CE tried to say, I got the law wrong, and of course it was he who got the law wrong. It was the MPC decision that he was talking about, and it was December 2007 when the MPC decision came out, saying that Hong Kong may have universal suffrage of the chief executive in 2017, and the word used was may. And actually, 2020 was not mentioned in the MPC decision. What it says was thereafter, the legislative council election may, you may have universal suffrage in for the legislative council. So it was thereafter that, and the next legislative election after 2017 is actually 2020. So that's how the year came about. Now, Chia Xiaoyang, who's from MPC, he's the deputy director, he's already said that this timetable is a solemn one, and the term he used was that the door is open, the green light is there, but in order to walk through, you have to go through five steps. And the five step actually was already a broken promise, because originally, if you look at the basic law, it was three steps. The three step in the basic law was two thirds of legislators passing the resolution, and then the CE consenting. And then for the chief executive election, it was approval by the MPC. And then for LegCo, the third step was keeping the record by the MPC. So in other words, because LegCo election was a matter of internal affairs, there was no need for approval by MPC. But then in 2004, there was an interpretation of the basic law by the MPC standing committee by adding two extra steps in front of the three steps. And these two extra steps were, first of all, the chief executive has to make a report to the MPC standing committee, and then the MPC standing committee has to authorize, in other words, to give the green light for the public consultation to begin. So to answer your question, what it means is that, yeah, the MPCs said that you may have direct election to chief executive in 2017, but then you still have to get the chief executive to put in a report, there has to be approval, and then there has to be public consultation, the government has to put forward a resolution, that resolution has to be passed by two-thirds majority in LegCo, and then approved by the CE, and then approval by MPC. So that's the five steps. So, well, I tell you that Henry Tang may be the chief executive in the next term, or it may be CY Leung, but of course they have to run through an election, and who knows what's going to happen. So that's the meaning of maybe, and it also means may not be.
Thank you, Chair. Audrey, I pose this comment and question as a member and supporter of the Civic Party. I just asked Robin to clarify something. The functional constituency issue, I'm a little confused. One, are functional constituency as a concept or an idea, is that enshrined in the basic law? I don't think so. Yes? No? If functional constituency,
it's in Annex 2 of the basic law.
So it's
Annex 2 of the basic law.
Oh, it is in the basic law?
Annex 2, that's right, in the basic law.
Okay. Then the next question is about functional constituency, and yes, we certainly go. I support the idea of the party in terms of doing away with functional constituencies, but as they exist today, wouldn't it be possible to, in Hong Kong, multi-layered society, probably thousands of layers and sectors, that first presentation, for instance, teachers, education, arts, science. It isn't just, shall we say, more doubtful, dodgy elements of the society, but there's some good in there too somewhere. Why throw the baby out with the bathwater? Couldn't it be possible to retain the idea and simply take away the legislative teeth and keep them around as a nice debating society advisory board come advocacies, as outlet for their various constituencies? That might soften the blow to the current establishment.
Yeah, thank you for the question. First of all, just to explain the legal bit first, Basic Law Article 68 talks about ultimate aim is direct election of all LegCo members. And Annex 2 to the Basic Law sets out the first 10 years of Legko's composition. And the idea was to have a gradual and orderly progress towards direct election of all Legko members. Because if you look at it, the ratio of directly elected members was to increase. In the first Legko term, it was 20 out of 60. In the second Legko term, it was 24 out of 60. In the third Legko term, it's 30 out of 60. And that was 2007-2008. And the original design of the basic law, when it was first drafted, was that by 2008, we could then move on to universal suffrage. And I have books, for example, printed by the Central Party saying that is the meaning of gradual and orderly progress, an increase of the number of directly elected seats. But it was stopped by the MPC decision, twice stopped. That was the MPC decision in 2004 and also in 2007. And that said that the ratio of directly elected seats and functional constituencies ought to remain at 50-50. And that's why it's been kept at 30 out of 60. Now, to come back to your question also about advisory bodies, of course, Legko, in fact, listens to advice of all kinds, not only from experts, but from the public, from all sectors, all the time. Every time it has to debate a bill or a policy, we invite deputations. It's Legko's duty to listen to advice. But the difficulty and the difference with functional constituencies is that they actually have a vote. And also, if you look at the composition of each functional constituencies. By the way, this was not done by basic law. This is actually done by local legislation, chapter 542. And you really ought to look at it because it's a bit of an arbitrary junk. You know, it was done by the provisional legislature and they put just through in bodies and say, well, you have a vote in this functional constituencies and that's the composition for this functional constituencies. For example, for the banking sector, it's 132 banks. You know, how many people are in the banking business? Why 132 banks? In the insurance business, again, it's 100 odd insurance companies, but what about brokers? You know, in the transport sector, again, it's about 100 odd bodies. But what about taxi drivers? And there is no rhyme or reason to how each functional constituency is designed or, composed of. You talk about teachers, it's about 90,000 teachers electing one representative. So that's why when you look at the larger the bodies, the more likely it is to produce a democratic representative whose function of getting into Legko is actually to vote out that functional constituency. Last night during the debate, when I asked Donald Zhang that question, I already knew he was going to cite Margaret Ng and Zhou Enguo. But unfortunately, because of the debating time, I couldn't actually preempt his answer by saying, don't quote me, Margaret, you know, because she was there. In fact, the purpose she wanted to run in this election to be there was not only just to do the job of a legislator, but also to be able to vote out her seat or the lawyer's seat in Legko. That was her platform at the time. But again, you know, the short answer is, if we want advice, we can have all sorts of advice, but this is not at the moment how functional constituencies are operating. They are putting their sectorial interest above the public interest, and they are refusing to give up their vested interest. And this is what's hurting Hong Kong. This is what's splitting the society. And it was wrong for the chief executive to shirk his constitutional duty and blame us for doing that. And he says, well, if you don't pass this package, you're splitting society. No, he's putting up a package, which if you look at all the public polls, opinion polls, people are opposed to it. A large sector of the public is opposed to it. So don't paint me as a radical for opposing it. You can't paint 40-50% of the Hong Kong public as radical in opposing his package. It's his package, it's splitting Hong Kong society, and he ought to go back to the drawing board and give us a roadmap.
We have time for one more question, last stops last, including, of course, our colleagues from over here. Characteristic silence.
No.
That worries me.
No.
What have I done wrong?
I'm going to step up.
So we have an idea of what you're trying to achieve, but literally now in the short to medium term, what next for you in what you're trying to get done in Hong Kong?
As I said, in the next few days, it's start and go, board in the court of the central authorities. If they approve Democratic Party's package, the vote will go through. And the Democratic movement may well be split because there are a lot of people in Hong Kong who have been fighting for democracy for a very long time. And they really have their eyes on the ultimate aim, and that's to have a clear timetable and a roadmap for the abolition of what is really a very unfair system in Hong Kong. And therefore, they will be very disappointed that we've missed the chance to fight for a roadmap. They would want the Democrats to be united in fighting for a roadmap. But whatever is the outcome, I understand that, you know, having gone on for so long, this democratic movement, somehow, you know, some people can have different views, and I respect different views. I think, you know, everybody will have to deal with a new situation. For myself, as I said, I would be able, I'm sure, to work with different parties with different views. But if it doesn't go through, then my estimate would be the tension would be there on the government to get something done. And they try very hard to blame the Democrats for stopping progress. But if you look at the latest polls, people were asked who they would blame most if this constitutional reform does not go through. 38% blame the central authorities. And really, we have to analyze the situation to see, as I said, who has weighed the anchor for reform. And it's clearly the central authorities and the people who refuse to give up their vested interests. I'm prepared to compromise. I'm prepared to allow people time. But there has to be a phasing out of these functional constituency seats. If Hong Kong has to go forward as a harmonious society, we need a fair electoral system. It's really, at the end of the day, very simple and elementary fair play.
Can I say that's the last question? We're going to squeeze just one more in.
Last night when I was taking a taxi, a taxi driver just said your performance was amazing, and he said if you run the next chief executive election, you're gonna win. So will you run the next chief executive election?
No.
Straight answer from a politician.
No, politicians usually never say never. I'm not a very good politician. That's why my answer is a straight one.
Really like to thank you very much. I ought to say that Audrey Yu has been doing back-to-back interviews since very early this morning. But unlike the chief executive who drew the short straw of going to a Rotary Club lunch today, she of course is with us in the FCC. And it's the tradition in the FCC to present our speaker with a gift. Our gift is a particularly appropriate one because I'm guessing, I'm not absolutely sure, that you might have to be spending some time in the streets. So this is a FCC jacket. It's riot-proof, waterproof, and extreme-proof.
Thank you.